Hello, citizens. This is Deadbug. Friend. Lover. Father. Father of many, actually. And some of them are from those godless third world countries. And I gotta support them all. Well, not the ones from the godless third world countries, because, you know, their cords can't touch me. But nevertheless, the other ones, I gotta divvy up some money sometimes. And you can help me. Sign up to my Patreon, where you get hundreds of my podcasts and three times as many of my films. And you won't be disappointed.
No siree, Bob.
And I'll also send you intimate photos when I'm drunk. So what are you waiting for? I'll see yous all over there. God bless each and every one of yous. Well, except for yous from those godless nations, which I won't mention. But your money is still good. Oh, and remember, with each 100th sign up, I'm going to buy one of my kids a pack of smokes and maybe even get them vaccinated. I thank you. You're about to partake in the Deadbug podcast. And as always, this podcast may not be suitable for younger listeners. So before we begin, I will ask of you one thing. Do you sit back? You shut that pleasure-giving mouth of yours. Smoke 'em if you got 'em. And enjoy. December 1958. The Girl on the Beach, Part 1. Australia. A country full of kangaroos, men in Daisy Duke shorts, and lesbians. All of which are unappealing, except for maybe kangaroos. Which, if I'm being honest, I don't give a fuck about them either. The year, December 1958. Australia was a nation that believed it knew exactly what it was. The Second World War was over. The economy was booming. Televisions flickered in living rooms for the first time, playing American reruns, a Laurel and Hardy, and probably old shitty Australian shows with Australians in them. Families packed the beaches, drove shiny Holdens, and spoke confidently about the future, at least on the surface. Because beneath the optimism sat another Australia, an Australia that rarely appeared in postcards, an Australia divided by race, class, geography, and silence. And in the final days before Christmas in 1958, in a remote town on the edge of the continent, those cracks were split wide open. This is a story of Mary Haddam, a 9-year-old girl, and a murder that shocked a nation. And a case that nearly 70 years later still raises a simple question. Did Australia get it right? Or did the country convince itself that it had? To understand the crime, you first have to understand the place. Sejuna, South Australia, today is known as the gateway to Nullarbor. But in 1958, there was a tiny, isolated settlement on far western edge of the state. One road in, one road out. A place where everybody knew everybody else's business. Yeah. And I guess that sounds like a bit of a cliche today. But back then, they were true. The population was only around 1,200 people. Fishing boats bobbed in the harbor. Children roam the beaches unsupervised. Doors left unlocked. And news traveled quicker than a spastic on roller skates going down the side of a mountain. Which I can imagine will be pretty fast, and I sure like to see that. If a stranger arrived in town, well, people would notice. And if something terrible happened, they'd know the full stories before sunset. By the Christmas of 1958, it was hot and it was bright. Christmas decorations hung in shop windows. Families prepared for the holidays. Children counted the days until Christmas morning. The world felt normal, safe, predictable. Or at least, predictable enough. Australia itself was under the leadership of Prime Minister Sir Robert Menzies, a man whose name was synonymous with stability. The country was experiencing strong economic growth, rising home ownership, and expanding industry. For many Australians, these were prosperous years. The typical Australian family looked very different from today. Dad worked. Mum stayed at home. At least that was the ideal setup that were constantly in the women's magazines and advertisements. Men worked the docks, farms, the railways, and the factories. Women were expected to raise the children, keep house, prepare the meals. And there were good times. The average wage was rising. Suburbs were growing. And Australians were buying things their parents could never imagined. Like soap. Nah, I'm just joking there. Cars, televisions, refrigerators. The future seemed like it had arrived. But not for everyone. Because while white Australia celebrated prosperity, the indigenous Aborigines, or Abos as they were known as, well, for them, life were entirely different. A different reality, one may lyrically wax. In many parts of the country, they faced restrictions on movement, employment, and even alcohol consumption. Which I don't think is a totally bad idea if you've ever had the displeasure of seeing an Aboriginal drunk. Some required official exemptions to exercise rights the white Australians simply took for granted. Many Australians preferred not to think about it. Many never saw it. I guess out of sight, out of mind, especially in the big cities. But in remote towns like Sejuna, those divisions were impossible to ignore, and they would soon become central to one of the most controversial criminal cases in Australian history. On Friday, December 19th, 1958, a traveling carnival rolled into town with its stinky carnies and filth-based workers. But for children, it was magic. Bright lights, music, games, noise, excitement. In a place as isolated as Sejuna, a carnival just wasn't entertainment. It was an event. The kind people talked about for weeks. And for the kids, even longer. Workers unloaded equipment. Stalls were assembled, getting ready for their annual grift. Locals gathered to see what had arrived. And for a few days, Sejuna felt larger than it really was. Among those traveling with the carnival that year were a 27-year-old Arunda man named Rupert Maxwell Stewart, and being a Runda or some kind of tribe. I'm guessing that one is real name, but I guess his real name don't matter now. It's lost in time. But most people simply knew him as Max. At that point, he was just another carnival worker, a grifter, passing through town. Nobody imagined that within days, his name would appear in newspapers all across Australia. Nobody imagined politicians, judges, journalists, and eventually a royal commission would become involved in his life. For now, he was just simply another Aboriginal.
And there wasn't nothing original about him, traveling with a bunch of other filthy, stinky carnies. Just another face on a traveling freak show.
You know, I'm sure they're all right. I don't want to seem too judgmental. And as Zajuna prepared for another hot December weekend, nobody there knew that 9-year-old Mary Haddam's death clock was now ticking. Like thousands of Australian children in the 1950s, Mary enjoyed a freedom that would seem extraordinary today. Children walked to their friends' houses alone, played outside for hours, explored beaches and scrubland without any supervision.
And yeah, sure, parents worried.
But the dangers that dominate modern parenting hadn't yet entered everyday life back then. Most especially in a place like Sejuna. At least not in 1958. Not 2 weeks before Christmas. The following afternoon, Saturday, December 20th, Mary would head out to play near the beach. The sun would be high.
And let's not forget that December is summer in Australia.
And the sea was calm, and nothing about the afternoon would initially seem unusual. No screams were reported, no obvious struggle, no witnesses running for help. Just a small coastal town carrying on with a summer weekend. But before the day was over, an entire community would find itself searching in the darkness. And Australia would begin one of the most bitterly disputed criminal cases in its history. A case involving race, politics, the death penalty,
and a horrific murder that would remain controversial to this very day. A murder that took an innocent 9-year-old child from this world.
Part 2. The Search. Saturday, December 20th, 1958. Sejuna. The temperature had climbed through the afternoon. Children were everywhere. Adults took cover from the heat. The school year was ending. Christmas was less than a week away. And the carnival remained in town. Families drifted between the beach, the shop, and the attractions that appeared almost overnight. For most people, it was a completely ordinary day. The kind of day, mind you, forgotten almost as soon as it ends. But for one family, it would become a date burned permanently into their memory. Because sometime during the afternoon, 9-year-old Mary Haddam disappeared. At first, nobody panicked.
The pretty 9-year-old was popular. Unfriendly, man was known to drift from location to location thing with different groups of friends. So why would they be nervous? This was 1958. Children came and went. They wandered. They explored. Sometimes they stayed out longer than expected. In a small town like Sojourner, people looked out for one another. If a child got lost, someone usually knew where they were. But as the afternoon slipped into evening, concern slowly replaced confidence. Mary hadn't returned. Friends hadn't seen her. Neighbors hadn't seen her. Nobody seemed to know where she'd gone. And with every passing hour, the questions took a more urgent tone. Where was she? Who had seen her last? And why hadn't she come home? As daylight faded, family members began searching. Then neighbors joined in. Then more locals.
And then the entire town.
And the search spread through the streets, the beaches, and open ground. People carried torches, called a name, checked places children might hide, places children might play, places children might accidentally become trapped. Nobody wanted to think about the worst, about the darker possibilities. Not yet.
But that fear loomed in the back of everyone's mind.
But because once you allow yourself to think the worst, you can never go back. The sun disappeared.
Now.
When darkness settled over Sojourner. And something changed. The atmosphere. The feeling. The optimism. The confidence. Start slipping away. The belief that everything would be all right. It all began to evaporate. People began to take their eyes off of the ground and looked up and locked eyes on one another. I guess they were looking for answers, looking for clues. Looking for assurance. Looking for somebody who knew something. Anything. Nobody did. The little girl remained missing. And the town grew silent. You can still imagine it. The sound of waves rolling onto the shore. The occasional barking dog. The distant hum of generators from the carnival grounds. And beneath it all, the creeping sense that something was terribly wrong. The following morning, the search resumed. Now larger. Now urgent. More determined. Volunteers combed the coastline. Others searched the scrubland. And police now joined the effort. People who had gone to bed hoping Mary would have been found safe woke up to a different reality. Because this was no longer a child who'd missed her curfew. Something had happened to her. But the question was, what? Hours passed. Then came the gruesome discovery. The kind of discovery every parent fears. The kind of discovery a searcher secretly dreads while convincing himself it won't happen. A body was found.
tiny body, with blonde, long, scraggly hair, and clouded blue eyes, near the shoreline. The search was over, and the nightmare was beginning. Word spread quickly about a girl who was nude in a town of barely more than 1,000 people. News traveled, frightening, like fire in the brushland. People stepped out of their verandas, gathering in small groups. The women wept. There was whispering. There was speculation. Many asked the same questions over and over. Was it really her? What happened? Who would do such a thing? No one had answers. Only rumors. Rumors of a naked body covered in maggots. Bites on a body from animals.
Or was still the killer?
Parts of it chewed off. And there were fear. And there were disbelief. His murders in them parts were rare. Child murders, rare still. This wasn't supposed to happen in places like Sejuna. Not here. Not to a little girl. Not days before Christmas. The kangaroo cops immediately secured the area. Investigators began examining the scene. Photographs were taken, measurements recorded, witnesses identified, movements retraced, every footprint, every mark, every discarded flip-flop and cigarette mattered, because somewhere among those details was a story. The story that pretty 9-year-old Mary Adam couldn't tell. And in those early hours,
the Australian police faced enormous pressure, because this was a town, a frightened town, that now wanted answers. Lynch mobs were now forming.
Newspapers, they wanted answers. Families wanted answers. Everyone in that town wanted to know what had happened. From the mayor to the retard who cleaned up the pig guts at the pig abattoir.
Well, maybe not that guy.
But this wasn't going to happen right away. This was rural Australia. And homicide investigations, even in big cities, don't begin with certainty. In small towns, you can forget about it. Because for an investigation like this, in a place like this, it begins with confusion, contradictions, half-truths, mistakes, and assumptions. Lots of assumptions. Especially in 1958. Especially in a remote town.
And most certainly when fear begins to influence judgment. And there were plenty of fear.
The carnival that had brought excitement to Sejuna suddenly looked different. People who had been welcomed only days earlier now became subjects of suspicion. Strangers who now stood out. Visitors stood out. Anyone unfamiliar
stood out.
Because when a community experiences a tragedy, it instinctively closes ranks and searches for explanations. And often, they search for somebody to blame. Police began interviewing witnesses, gathering statements, constructing timelines. Names were written down. Names were crossed off. Then written down again. Every freaking town was called in. And called in twice. Maybe given a little rough treatment to hopefully help him loosen his tongue. Every lead mattered. Every possibility mattered. At least for the moment. But before long, investigators would focus their attention on one particular man. A carny worker. An abbo, if I may be so bold to be so politically incorrect. An abbo from Central Australia. A man who only days earlier had been virtually unknown outside a small circle of acquaintances and under-12s who knew him, who worked the Flying Swan ride. His name? Max Stewart. And what happened next would ignite one of the biggest legal and political shitstorms that Australia had ever seen. Because while many people would come to believe police had found the killer, others would spend decades arguing
that they'd entrapped an innocent man.
And from this man would come a confession that would divide Australia for generations.
Part 4, The Confession.
By the morning of December 21st, 1958, the search for Mary Haddam was over. What searchers found on the shoreline would leave a permanent scar on the small town. The pretty 9-year-old had been a victim of a violent attack. Investigators quickly concluded that this was not an accident. Nor was it a simple disappearance. This was a homicide.
The evidence at the scene and the state of the body concluded that Mary had been the victim of a brutal sexual crime.
She was raped in the most gruesome of ways,
viciously penetrating the 3 holes available to the killer.
The fact that her body had been exposed to the coastal environment complicated parts of the forensic picture. Time, weather, and sure, the harsh Australian summer. All had begun their work before investigators had arrived, and yet there was no doubt about the central fact. The child had been murdered, and she'd been beaten. She'd been tortured. She'd been raped. And somebody in or around the town knew exactly what had happened. The pressure on the police was immediate, Christmas only being days away. Public fear was spreading. Parents kept their children close. Rumors circulated through the streets and the shops and the homes of the most grotesque of murders. And the people wanted answers. They wanted them fast. The investigation widened as witnesses were interviewed and every freaking pedo town were dragged in and given the phone book treatment to make sure that they told everything they knew.
And maybe a few things they didn't know.
And timelines were constructed. Movements were tracked. Attention eventually found and focused
on a traveling carny worker
who went by the name of Max Stewart, a 27-year-old abbo. That word's not mine. Who had a rap sheet longer than a retard's tongue licking ice cream off of his own belt buckle. An outsider from Central Australia. And at first he was just one of many that were questioned. Then he became the center of the investigation, and before long, the police announced what appeared to be a breakthrough. The abbo had made a confession. And to many Australians, that should have ended the story right there, because in their opinion, the abbo or the aborigine were subhuman. They were fucking animals who shit in the same place that they eat, and they smelt. Boy, oh boy, did they smell like a shit sandwich that had been left out in the Australian sun for 2 days. They were like vermin. And the confession? I guess the cops, it weren't too much of a surprise, being where we were from. It were like flies to shit. Just another dirty town. And a dirty island. By dirty people. But there were questions that would refuse to disappear. Questions that continued to echo decades later. Because Stewart's first language was not English. His education was limited. The statement attributed to him appeared to be more sophisticated, more eloquent than attributed to, by his own friend's account, a retard. Supporters would later argue that the confession, or at least parts of the confession, seemed more like the language used by the police than a retard. Critics dismissed those concerns. Police stood by their investigation. Prosecutors stood by their case. The dirty abbo had done it. Case closed. And the justice system moved forward. The trial attracted enormous attention. The prosecution argued that the confession spoke for itself. To them, the evidence was compelling. The filthy carny worker said he'd been drinking all day. They were high as a kite. We saw the pretty young girl. She came over. She wanted to go on a ride. And he said that he'd let her. Under one condition. After she went on that ride with him, she'd go for a walk.
And to this, she pinky promised.
And afterwards, he walked the pretty girl down to the beach. And he brutalized her. And every hole that God had given her. Probably a few she never knew she had. And that was an important fact because the police had told no one that. But the abbo knew. And there was only one way he knew that. Because he were there.
And he fucking did it. Just as sure as he didn't wear deodorant.
But the defense, they saw things very differently. They challenged aspects of the confession, raised concerns about the interpretation of that confession, and questioned whether Stewart had fully understood what was happening during the police questioning. After all, they were a semi-retard, and even they had rights. The courtroom became more than a place to determine guilt. It became a battleground. Not just over evidence, but over race, power, language, trust.
But in the end, I guess none of that mattered.
The jury convicted Max Stewart. And the sentence, it was severe. Death by hanging. For many Australians, justice have been delivered. Case closed. After all, he weren't the first abbo to get his hand caught in the cookie jar.
And it wouldn't be the last.
But not everybody agreed. Not even close. Because after the conviction, the story took an extraordinary turn. when a number of journalists began digging deeper. Among them were reporters connected to Adelaide's newspaper world. Questions that had once circulated quietly suddenly appeared in print. The case was dissected. Witnesses were re-examined. Police conduct came under scrutiny. The conviction became national news. And then one of Australia's most influential newspaper proprietors entered the battle. A young Rupert Murdoch. Long before he became an international media figure, Murdoch, through the weight and the influence of his newspapers, challenged the young Aboriginal's conviction. The campaign intensified along with public interest. What had seemed like a straightforward criminal case was transforming into something much larger. A national controversy. Appeals followed. Arguments continued. Supporters of Stewart insisted serious doubts existed. Supporters of the prosecution insisted the courts had reached the correct conclusion. Just another eyeball who'd been caught with his fingers in the fish pie. Their words, not mine. And the debate became fierce, emotional, political, and deeply divisive. Eventually, the matter became so significant that a royal commission was established. The commission examined allegations surrounding the investigation and the confession. Witnesses testified. Evidence was revisited. Arguments were heard once again. Several other Carney workers had seen the Abbo talking to the young girl. But only one saw Stewart and the little girl walking away together towards the beach. And by all accounts, he were even more drunk than the Carney he were ratting out on. So who you gonna believe here? And this was the issue. To the public, Carneys were deceitful, drunken, grifting liars. And they stink too. I just added that one in. But that was the public's perception. And that was the perception that the newspapers believed had helped find the Carney guilty. Yet even after all of this, and all the evidence put together, no one could agree on what had happened. Some believed the commission vindicated the authorities. Others believed that important questions remained unanswered. In the years that followed, Stewart's death sentence was commuted and never had his date with the hangman. Instead, he served years in prison before eventually being released. But release did not end the debate. If anything, it guaranteed the argument would continue, because there was never a moment when everyone accepted the same version of events. There was always competing narratives, competing interpretations, competing truths. Nearly 70 years later, historians, legal scholars, and true crime researchers still examine the case. And many conclude that Max Stewart was guilty of sin, and that police got the right man, and that some of the public were just feeling guilty about condemning a retard and an Aboriginal. Others believe the investigation was deeply flawed and racist. Many focused on the confession. Others focus on the broader social conditions of Australia in the 1950s, an era when Indigenous Australians often faced systematic prejudice and unequal treatment. An era when assumptions could influence outcomes. An era very different from the Australia we know today. And so the story of Mary Haddam remains two stories at once. The first is a tragic tale of a little blonde girl with piercing blue eyes, who was never seen without carrying her doll. A child who never had the chance to grow old. A family forever scarred, forever changed. A community forever marked. But the second story is the reason this case still appears in books, and documentaries, and court histories. It is a story of doubt, of uncertainty, a confession by a semi-retard that brought other questions, a conviction that divided a nation, and of a legal battle that refused to die. Mary Haddam's killer has been dead for many years. Or perhaps he was never correctly identified at all. That depends entirely on which side of the argument you believe. But what is beyond dispute is this. A 9-year-old girl lost her life. Australia was forced to confront uncomfortable questions about justice. And one small town on the edge of a continent became the center of a controversy that still echoes through Australian history. And nearly 7 decades later, the debate continues. And perhaps that is why the case remains so haunting. Not because we lack theories, but because we still lack certainty. And sometimes, uncertainty is the most unsettling of endings of all. Max Stewart died on November 21st, 2014. Most sources gave his birth being the year in 1932. That would have made him 82 years old when he died. Max Stewart never disappeared into obscurity once he was released from prison. He went on to become a respected elder of an Aboriginal tribe. Which one? I don't know, and it ain't important to the story. Unless you're related to him, which I don't think you are. On his deathbed, the former carny worker maintained his innocence. And I guess at the end of the day, we'll never know if he did it or he didn't. And that's a question that he'll have to answer when he meets his Abbo God.
Come back, broken coin, but I still hold on. Laundry line by the back fence, one blue shirt and your scent. Rain on the sill, mud on my shoes, every small thing still points to you. The kettle clicks, then goes still. I pour too much out of habit, and the whole room feels your name like a note I can't explain. And I if you miss me, just a little turn around, make it simple. Coin in the sink beside your key.